State Environmental Commission meeting, November 16th, 2016.
Noon after 10, so we want to get started. So we're going to start this meeting. For the record, this is the State Environmental Commission. It's Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. At a couple minutes past 10 in Carson City. The meeting location is in the Bryan Building located at 901 South Stewart Street, second floor, Tahoe Conference Room. The meeting will be video conference in Las Vegas at the Division of Environmental Protection Office located at 2030 East Flamingo Road, Suite 230. And I see we do have some, two or three people there. Thank you. Okay, with that, call to order. Val, we have a quorum, you've already said. The meeting has been properly noticed and posted.
Yes, sir.
According to law. And then just for my edification, item number five is what's happening.
So we were notified by Clark County School District that they are now in compliance with the regulations that were adopted during the last SEC meeting. And so that agenda item number five, has been pulled from today's meeting.
Great, good, good. Okay, second item on the agenda is a public comment. This is the time the public can come forward and speak. Just so the public knows that we will not take any action on anything that they might want us to if it's not agendized. So is there anybody either here or in Las Vegas from the public that would like to speak? Okay, seeing none.
Chairman Gantz, you should be bold.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Chairman Gantz. Good morning, members of the commission. I will proceed with roll call. Chairman Gantz.
Present.
Vice Chair Porta. Mr. Jim Barbie. Mr. Jason King.
Here.
Ms. Catherine Landreth.
Here.
Mr. Joe Friedland. Mr. Rich Perry.
Here.
Mr. Kerry Richardson.
Here.
Mr. Mark Turner.
Here.
And Mr. Tony Wadley. Also, counsel for the AG's office, Ms. Jennifer Chisholm.
Present.
Thank you.
So with that, we have a quorum.
We do have a quorum.
Okay, just double checking. Okay, item three is the approval of the October 12th, 2016 meeting minutes. I'm deferring to Jason on this one. He's our minute man since he catches these minute little errors.
I would move to approve.
Is there any comments from the commission on the motion or on the minutes? Okay, hearing none, votes in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried, ma'am.
We did get a second on the motion.
I did.
We did. Okay. Motion carried. Thank you, Mr. King. Item number four is alternative fuel waiver. I think we've seen this one once already, our last meeting. Who's going to speak on this one? Is there somebody in Vegas speaking on this one?
No.
Okay, then I want staff to speak on this one.
That's great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Danilo Dragoni. I'm the Bureau Chief over Quality Planning. With me is Sig Yanorez, Supervisor of the Mobile Smoke and Greenhouse Gas Branch. We were really hoping that someone was in Vegas today, especially the manager of the fleet in question. We worked in the past month with the manager of the fleet to come up with a plan, also based on the new regulation that we approved last month. And we believe that, we have no objection on the variance they are requesting right now. We believe that the plan should put them in compliance in the time that they are requesting. And so the problem with this fleet was that they have about 100 diesel vehicles that were not in compliance. So I'm going through their request. They're planning in these 3 years to either replace them with alternative vehicles and or install a device like telematics to put these vehicles in compliance. 3 years is a fair amount of time. It's a three budget cycles. So we believe that it's a fair request.
Now, bring us forward here. We had this in front of us last time where right. North Las Vegas did make a presentation,
mm-hmm.
and we held it. We held this item because of item number 8 on the agenda last month. So kind of tell us the action we took on the 8th,
right.
how it did or did not affect this particular agenda, because we held it because of that.
Right. So what happened in the 8th, we approved this new regulation, and this new regulation were also provision for new types of alternative vehicles and for new technology like telematics. And once we went back on the drawing board with the fleet, we figured out that some of these provisions, like for instance telematics, might help them in reaching faster their compliance. So they will start working towards their compliance right away, and so we believe that some of these changes that we made should be helpful for them in reaching compliance, in proceeding towards compliance a faster pace.
Okay, and so what we approved in agenda item 8 last month does not affect what they're requesting. The request still stands the same.
That's correct. They still have these 100. So what we approved last session is not changing, is not making any change in the number of vehicles that they have out of compliance. What is affecting is the process or the tools they have in order to put these vehicles in compliance. Okay.
Commissioner, have any questions of staff?
I recall the discussion was around reformulated gas, that was actually going to be a standard and that would actually negate the need. Can you clarify that?
So last month we were talking about, yes, so the RFG, reformulated gasoline, is a standard. Well, it was a standard a month ago, but in light of the fact that the new federal requirements would put basically the regular gasoline be the same as the RFG, we decided to put, basically to remove the RFG from the alternative fuel, from the regulation. Now, this is gasoline, so in this case, the change will not necessarily affect the current condition of the vehicles in the city of North Las Vegas, which are diesel. But it might provide more admonition for them in order to get into compliance.
Mr. Brayer, I had the same recollection. That's why I was asking the questions I'm asking. Val, the item that we pulled, that's the school district asking for something similar.
I believe that the regulation that was adopted put them in compliance without any further effort.
Okay, so in that case, the action we took last month did something different for the school district than it's doing for North Las Vegas.
That's correct. If my recollection is correct, the school district was in compliance until then, but they were afraid of not going to compliance in the future. But the new regulation basically allowed them to be in compliance. So the regulation is about acquisition of vehicles. Okay. And so the situation is different between the two fleets. In one case, the city of North Las Vegas had already about 100 vehicles in non-compliance. So for them, the problem is to actually put first those vehicles in compliance. For the school district, actually, it was more like a situation of moving forward. They were concerned about not going in non-compliance with the new acquisitions. But the new regulation basically allowed them to, for options, new options, different options that basically will keep them in compliance.
Any other comments or questions by the commission?
I just have a question. At Clark County School District, their fleet, their diesel fleet is powered by biodiesel.
That's correct.
So if they're able to meet, which is almost 70% of their fleet, so if they're able to meet the requirements with 70% of their fleet being diesel and utilizing biodiesel, wouldn't North Las Vegas have similar options available to them?
So, you want
to? I might be able to answer that. Sig Yon Rice with NDEP, Bureau of Air Quality Planning. The city of North Las Vegas does not own its own fuel storage tanks. That's really the problem. So they are at the mercy of either going to another fleet and getting fuel from their tank, and they have a way of making sure the billing goes to the right fleet, but borrowing the facilities of another fleet or trying to go out to a commercial supplier, and there are no commercial sites where they can drive up with their vehicles and get biodiesel. So that's the problem they've always had. They've either gone to other fleets, or they also complied by doing something called wet fueling, where they had a small tanker truck come with diesel, biodiesel fuel, and top off all the vehicles that were parked in their lot, which is a very inefficient way of running a fleet. So so they don't have the same options that a fleet like Clark County School District does that has their own fuel tanks.
Thank you.
Catherine?
Well, that was partially answered my question, but my recollection that was that part of their variance request was based on their financial situation, and that can they give any assurance that that will change to allow them to be in compliance in the three-year period?
This is Daniel Dragoni for the records. Looking at their request, I believe that their main concern was to having to basically go in compliance in a year or a few months. That would cost them, you know, a considerable amount of investment to replace all those cars at once. I believe that they are committing to, they're mentioning in their variance request that they are committing to investing the amount of money necessary to replace or update those vehicles in the 3 years budget cycle. So I believe that they should be able to. We believe, they should be able to.
It just seems like a substantial number of vehicles for them to replace.
I think they described a plan. Sorry, I need to. In their petition, I'm quoting, if the city is required to replace all non-compliant vehicles immediately, it will likely cost in excess of $3.12 million. The city of, still quoting, the city of Fleet Services Division currently has a vehicle replacement budget of $1.65 million this year and expect a similar replacement budget for the foreseeable future. So I do believe that in terms of a financial, they have been planned for this replacement. It's going to take 3 years instead of, one shot.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions from the commission?
I think that there is some flexibility that's warranted here based on some discussions that took place in Las Vegas at the last meeting. That sum of money is a substantial sum of money for the North Las Vegas School District. But as one of the commenters noted last time, the number of vehicles they have in comparison to the total number of registered vehicles in Clark County is infinitesimally small. And there is basically an immeasurable benefit from pushing them forward into doing something like this. We can't really see a benefit of pushing something like this. And I think there's nothing wrong with allowing them to utilize the budget parameters that they have to meet this need over a reasonable length of time when they represented was 0.0001% of the entire number of vehicles registered in Clark County. So that tells me that you couldn't measure the difference anyway. So why push it? But if they would commit to utilizing their existing budget structure to move in that direction over a few years, I would be satisfied with that.
Great point. Anybody in Vegas that wants to comment, or in this audience here, public comment on this? Okay, seeing or hearing none, I'd ask our attorney, Jennifer, if we can go ahead with this in light of North Las Vegas not being here to support their request, and she tells me that it's okay. We can take action if the commission wants to take action on this. So with that, if there's no other comments or discussion, we need a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion to approve the petition for variance, agenda item 4, providing the city of North Las Vegas 36 months to comply with NRS NAC Chapter 486A due to financial hardship and unavailability of alternative fuel options.
I'll second that motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the input. Tell, call North Las Vegas and say that they owe you. Okay, the next item on the agenda is item number 5, which has been pulled. And also, I want to make clear that although you mentioned North Las Vegas School District, just North Las City of. Just for the record, because that's going to come out in minutes. Okay, item number 6. We have a B&R Constructions. We have our staff ready to pull the trigger on this.
Good morning, Chairman Ganz, members of the commission. My name is Jeff Kinder. I am the chief of the Bureau of Air Pollution Control. With me this morning is Travis Osterhout, compliance and enforcement supervisor. We have 3 penalty recommendations for your consideration this morning. Agenda item 6 is BR Constructors, notice of alleged violation 2567. We are recommending approval of a penalty for $1,400 for failing to apply for and obtain an operating permit. B&R Constructors, we first became aware of them because of complaints from neighbors. Staff went on site, found that BR Constructors was working to prepare an approximately 18-acre site known as the Canyon Vista Development for construction of residential homes in the southeast area of Carson City.
Excuse me. Again. That should do it. Sorry.
Staff went on site and found that BR Constructors had cleared the entire site, 18 acres, and conducted grading operations for construction of the homes without applying for and obtaining a surface area disturbance permit. Surface area disturbance permits are required for sites greater than 5 acres. Primary concern is NAC 445B22037 that requires best practical measures be put in place to prevent controllable particulate matter from becoming airborne. Quick chronology of the site of the issue. On March 14th of this year, we received a complaint from a homeowner. Staff went on site, found that there was blowing dust, contacted the owner. The next day, March 15th, we contacted the owner, Scott Smith, as well as the contractor, and identified that there was no permit in place. That very same day, the contractor submitted an application for a surface area disturbance permit to our office. On March 18th, 4 days after our initial complaint, the owner notified us that reseeding and palliatives had been applied and that they were working on less than 5 acres. The owner was very responsive to our concerns. March 23rd, we were notified that the original contractor, BR Constructors, was no longer the contractor on site. March 29th, we issued the surface area disturbance permit to the new contractor, Sierra View Equipment. July 5th, we issued a draft notice of alleged violation. July 6th, we issued an amended notice of alleged violation, or excuse me, amended surface area disturbance permit to the appropriate owner because we had incorrect information. July 26th, an enforcement conference was held, and August 12th, we issued a final notice of alleged violation, 2567. With that, Travis can walk us through the penalty matrix calculations.
Thank you. Good morning. So to go through the penalty matrix for violation 2567, there's a base penalty as stipulated by the penalty matrix on page 1, constructing or operating without a permit for a SAD, Class 2 SAD. The base penalty is $500 plus $50 per acre for 18 acres, which totals $1,400. There were no other deviation factors or anything calculated as it was simply operating without a permit. The discretionary timeline per the penalty matrix is weeks to months. And during the enforcement conference, we met with the owner, we met with the contractor. They established a timeline of approximately 1 week from the time that they disturbed soil and completed clearing the 18 acres to the time that we notified them, and they applied palliatives to stabilize the site and only work on an area of less than 5 acres. So we established 1 week of that time frame of the operating more than 5 acres disturbed. There were no economic benefits taken into account, and they had no previous penalties issued to them, so there were no additional penalty adjustment factors, for a total of $1,400. So, just for information, two additional fugitive dust violations were issued on the permit subsequent to this date, so those weren't taken into account on these penalty factors. They were issued as administrative fines, and they were paid immediately. And the owner's been extremely good to work with. As Jeff said, he's been responsive to everything we requested, and has been on top of it when we've been out to the site and gotten complaints from homeowners that are immediately adjacent.
A question, probably from my curiosity. It sounded like if the contractor had pursued the way they normally would pursue construction, they wouldn't have torn up 18 acres. They would have torn up maybe 2 or 3 acres. In that case, an air permit is not needed by them?
Correct. 5 acres or more is required for a surface area disturbance permit. Okay. However, they are still subject to fugitive dust requirements regardless of the size. But in this case, the owner explained to us that they intended to open up specific areas to develop the homes. However, due to unforeseen circumstances with fill material coming in and whatnot, they were required to clear the entire site at once to use fill material from the site to compensate for other areas of the site.
So that deviation kind of caught them?
It did. I don't feel that they intended to act in that manner until these issues came up.
Right. Questions from commission, please?
I have a math question.
Go ahead.
Since you can disturb up to 5 acres without a permit, would the multiplier for the $50 per acre fine, should that be 13 acres rather than the 18? Because the first five are...
Well, I would agree with you. I've gone by the penalty matrix, which says $500 plus $50 per acre of planned disturbance. So in my mind, reading that as every acre of disturbance would be calculated for that.
All right, so you don't get the first 5 acres for free then?
I guess not.
Okay.
We may have to revise the penalty permit. Okay. Or the penalty matrix.
It can always depend on the engineering types to second guess you on these
companies. Absolutely. Well, he does this stuff for a living, so can't hold it against him.
Any other questions by the commission? Anybody here from the public? Probably the constructors aren't here. Anybody in there? They are here?
There is a representative
here. Do they want to make a comment? Or?
I would love to.
Good.
I'm Scott
this
Smith.
This is your day in court here.
Okay. I'm just here. We're guilty.
My name is Scott Smith. I'm the owner of the project. I'm with Davini Nevada LLC. A lot of this could have been avoided with some different regulations as far as on a city or a county level when you go to get a permit. We originally did our streets. We weren't going to mass grade the property, and we got a stormwater permit. We didn't need a dust permit because we were not doing more than 5 acres. Then we decided we didn't have enough fill to build our pads on, so we were trying to get some dirt from the NDOT because they had that huge pile. And so I talked to the contractors over there, and we pretty much had a deal. And then I got an email from the state saying that they wanted all these different studies and all this stuff, which was $50,000 and months and months and months of delay. So we decided we would do a mass grading and pull the dirt from the property, so we had to get rid of all the sagebrush. We went into the city with our mass grading plans. This is where I think that the breakdown happens, is because when we got our permit for the roads, they asked us to we had to have a stormwater permit in order to get our permit to start the roads. So when we did the mass grading, we kind of thought maybe they should have said something that, yeah, you guys need a dust permit before we give you a permit. So that's kind of, I think maybe there's could be a sometime some kind of a checklist or something that could be handed down to all the counties. So if you are disturbing more than 5 acres, there's a box they check and they say you got to have a dust permit, and you have to hand that in before we give you your actual permit to start work. I think that would solve the problem of having this kind of thing happen. And it was basically a miscommunication. And my contractor did come to this building to discuss a stormwater permit. And when he came, he went to, I don't know which floor, but I think it's the second floor or the third floor. I don't know, you guys have five floors here of stuff. And he asked the person he talked to about the stormwater permit, he says, is there anything else I need? And they said, no, you're good to go. And he went, okay. So we started. And so that's kind of what I think, that there's just a couple of maybe some checks and balances that could be put in place from your standpoint that might alleviate this problem down the road, so we don't have this issue. But we did not have a permit. We did open it all up, and once we found out we were in violation, I did the permit, paid the fees, brought it personally right down here that same day, and got the dust palliative ordered, and we've been maintaining it ever since. And then that contractor I did have, I let go because he did not have the proper equipment to maintain the dust. He needed bigger water trucks, and plus the wind was just howling last winter, so it was one of those things where you needed a lot of stuff out there. So we finally got that under control, and we did put a dust palliative down, and we've been continuing to do that every 6 to 8 months, depending when it needs it. So, and we're continuing out there right now. We've put a nice layer of dust palliative down on everything except for where we are constructing, and we're still running a water truck. So we're very cognizant of the problem, and we don't want any problems. This is the last thing I want to do is be sitting in front of you guys.
Well, I don't think, from what I've heard from staff and what I hear from you, that we're questioning your integrity.
Oh,
I think
thank
it's
you.
Pretty obvious.
No.
So what you found is you found a big pile of dirt and didn't really realize the bureaucracy behind that pile of dirt.
Yeah. In fact, I was told that since I was not a public entity, that I could not use that pile of dirt without all of these. They wanted a archaeological study, and they wanted soil, or no, it was a, I can't remember the other study, but I started looking into it, and I figured, well, if we can get these done real quick, well, that doesn't happen very fast, and it was rather expensive, and I didn't have the time to be waiting around for that, so we decided to do the mass grading, and we had that set through the city, and that's when, I think, when we applied for that mass grading permit and submitted our plans, they could be a cross-check there to say, yeah, you guys need a dust permit, otherwise we're not giving you your permit. I think that'd be fairly simple to achieve in that with all the counties in the whole state. You know, just it's a simple checkbox, you know. So, it's a checks and balance. So I think that's something that you might want to look at. But
it's my
layman's two cents.
Questions from the commission for the gentleman?
I'm in the same business as he is. And what I've found is that just the last couple of years, just because there's been such a large amount of turnover at Carson City, for example, in the engineering services division, and here at the state, that you have new people that are learning and getting trained, and a lot of the old hands that had this information at their fingertips have retired or gone on to other careers. So my most recent subdivision work required an extensive amount of question asking as well, and we got the answers because we knew that you needed to have something for these things. But there was a number of people who, on the other side, just weren't completely up to speed on who needs what and when you have to have it and that sort of thing. So I do see the possibility out there for miscommunication while you have new staff that's coming on board and learning the ropes. And subdivision building in and of itself is a relatively new construct here in Northern Nevada in the last 24 months. There really hasn't been any dirt turned for residential subdivisions up until about the last 12 to 18 months. So people that were coming in after the recession, everybody was like, oh, subdivisions? Okay, let me look at this again. And we haven't seen one in 10 years. So
yeah.
I can understand where he's coming from there.
You know, we brought this to the city. They were kind of going, wow, we haven't done this in so long.
Yeah.
They all had to kind of, they're all reading their books going, what do we do?
Yeah. Turn dirt on a new subdivision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mark.
10 years.
That's very pertinent. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you for...
anybody else from the audience in Vegas or here that would like to speak on this subject?
Okay. If there's nobody else, this is Travis Ostrad again for the record. I just wanted to note that we haven't had any other fugitive dust issues since spring, since he hired the new contractor and took care of things. So.
But I would just mentioned that you heard what he said. I don't know if there's something we can do about this. Mark is sure confirming the same thing. So
There have been internal discussions of how to possibly create some sort of a checklist to flag towards which bureaus would require permits or something. So we move at the speed of state.
Might have saved you $1,400.
You know, I chalk it up to educational expenses.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Any other comments or discussions from the commission? Hearing none, we need a motion.
I'll move to approve NOAV 2567, the amount of $1,400.
Second?
I'll second that.
Thank you. A motion. We have a second. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you very much.
That brings us to item number 8.
Item number
same group going to speak on this one, too?
Item number 7.
Oh, excuse me, 7. I'm sorry. Yeah, you got more than one, don't you? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Jeff Kinder again for the record. Agenda item number 7 is recommended penalties for Jarrett Canyon Gold. Notice of alleged violation 2568. We are recommending approval of a penalty for $12,885 for failing, exceeding a permitted emission limit during a source test. Jarrett Canyon Gold operates a gold ore mining and processing facility in Elko County, located approximately 50 miles north of Elko. Jarrett Canyon Gold holds a Class 1 Title 5 air quality operating permit. The primary pollutant emissions from System 35B, which is their ore dryer, is particulate matter, PM and PM10. Just as a note, this is by far the largest emitting particulate matter source at the mine site, with permitted emissions of 44.5 tons per year. And the system is controlled by a backhouse, dual backhouses. Quick chronology. November 5th of last year, Jarrett Canyon conducted permit-required source testing. January 12th of this year, we received the source testing report. Noted in that report was failure to show compliance with their permitted emission limit of 10.16 pounds per hour. The tested measured emission limit emissions were 17.45, approximately a little bit less than double of their permitted emissions. July 1st of this year, we issued draft notice of alleged violation 2568. On July 27th, we held an enforcement conference, and on July 28th, final notice of alleged violation 2568 was issued. The facility, once they recognized that they had a failed source test, conducted an investigation and determined there were numerous mechanical failures with the baghouse. Those have since been corrected, and in July of this year, they retested and showed compliance with their permit limit. One final note before Travis walks us through the penalty matrix. This facility has many, many previous compliance issues. However, the facility is under new ownership, and this is the first violation, alleged violation under new ownership. So we elected not to use the multipliers of previous compliance issues and instead treated this as the first violation for this facility under this ownership. With that, Travis can walk us through the penalty matrix.
Thank you. Good morning again. Travis Ostrout for the record. So to walk through the penalty matrix for NOAV 2568, the base penalty for failed source test for Class 1 facility major pollutant per the penalty matrix is $7,500. The adjustment for volume release, they were 171.8% of the permit limit. So per the emission ratio guidance on page 3 of the penalty matrix, if the emissions are greater than or equal to 1.2 of the permit limit, then you apply the exceedance proportionally, which we discussed in the last SEC meeting in February, where we discussed why would you not take off the one, and the logic being that if you are less than one, then you're actually reducing the base penalty. So we applied this proportionally, $7,500 times 1.718 totals $12,885. The penalty matrix timeline basis guideline says for each test, so that's a multiplier of one. Again, there were no economic benefits taken into account, and there were no previous penalty adjustment factors applied, as Jeff stated, that we treated this as a clean slate for the new ownership, not to penalize them for previous ownership's poor compliance history. That gives us a total of $12,885 proposed for the failed source test.
Commission questions?
Are these source tests part of the five-year air permit? permit renewal?
They were part of the compliance testing requirements. And let me look at the violation real quick.
Just curious how often you do this.
Yeah, Jeff Kinder for the record. Because of the size of this source and how critical the baghouse is in controlling emissions, this is an annual testing requirement.
Annual. Correct.
Any comments, questions from the commission?
Question, if you hadn't taken into consideration this new ownership, do you know what the multiplier could have been?
The multiplier could have been, for their violation history, they had 8 previous violations, so at 5% apiece, that would be 40% multiplier, times 12,000. So you would have had a total of $18,039.
Thank you.
Additional commission questions or comments? Is the representative here from this company? Seeing none, I would then open the comments to the public. Anybody in Vegas or here want to comment on this particular item?
Chairman Gans, Bell King for the record. On behalf of the commission, I had contacted the owner, the new owner of Jared Canyon, to find out if he was going to be present today. He said he was not contesting the penalty. He said he also wouldn't be present today, but he emphasized that he had had a very favorable experience working with NDEP throughout this process.
We'll strike that last comment. Okay. I see no one from Vegas or here in the audience that wants to give any comments. With that, I'll come back to the commission then. And if there's no further discussion by the commission, a motion is in order.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve the penalty recommended for Jarrett Canyon Gold of $12,885 for NOAV 2568.
Second?
Second.
A motion is made and seconded. Follow the recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? None. Motion carries. Now can I go to 8?
Yes, sir. Jeff Kinder for the record. Agenda item number 8 is proposed penalties for Highcroft Resources and Development. Notice of alleged violations 2585 and 2586, and I apologize, there is a lot of moving parts on this one, so bear with us. We are recommending penalties for Highcroft of $3,600 for notice of alleged violation 2585 for failure to conduct required source testing, and $43,920 for notice of alleged violation 2586 for failing to meet permitted emission limits. Highcroft Resources and Development operates a gold ore processing facility in Humboldt County, located approximately 55 miles west of Winnemucca. They also hold a mercury operating permit to construct for their thermal mercury units, and they hold a number of other permits for their various other emission sources. The primary pollutant of concerns for the three systems we're talking about today are systems 1, 2, and 3, and that's mercury. And it should be noticed that Highcroft, based on the potential to emit, is a Class 2 minor source. However, they're subject to the Federal Mercury MAC, or the Federal Mercury Maximum Achievable Control Technology requirements, which stipulates that they must have a Title V permit, even though they are a minor source. So they have basically three permits. They have a Title V permit for their thermal sources, mercury-emitting thermal sources, as well as a state-issued mercury operating permit to construct, and a Class 2 minor source permit for their remaining emission sources. Quick chronology. In April this year, they conducted annual mercury source testing on these three systems. System 1, the mercury retort number 1. System 2, the mercury furnace number 1. And System 3, the mercury retort number 2. In June of this year, we received the source testing report. Identified in that report were a couple of issues. The first, the federal requirements require that there be no more than 15 months between mercury tests. In this case, System 1 was 16 months, System 2 was also 16 months, and System 3 was 18 months between tests. Also identified in this report was 2 permitted emission limit violations. System 1 was approximately 200% of the permitted emission limit, and System 3 was approximately 350% of the permitted emission limit for mercury. July 28th, we issued draft notice of alleged violations. July 29th, we had an enforcement conference. And on August 31st, final notice of alleged violations 2585 and 2586 were issued. In looking at the penalty matrix, we have the option of going class one for exceeding permitted emission limits, or we could treat them as a minor source class two. We elected to treat them as a minor source because this is a state-issued mercury permit in which the violations occurred. However, they missed their federal testing requirements. So Travis will explain how the penalty matrix applies in the two different notice of alleged violations.
Before Travis explains, by making that determination to go to a minor source, are we going to be questioned by the federal area?
No, because they are in compliance with the federal mercury standards, which are quite a bit higher than state-only mercury standards. Okay. The state-only mercury, Nevada Mercury Control Program was put in place before the federal standard. The federal standard was modeled off our state-only permit. However, they raised the limits pretty significantly when they established their program.
And Travis Osterhout, for the record, I'll also add that we considered they have multiple permits, as Jeff stated, and they're also in a partial construction phase due to bankruptcy and whatnot. So we, in trying to take the most fair look at this possible, we considered what emission units they actually have in place constructed that can operate right now. Taking into account they didn't violate the federal MACT, they violated our state standards. We then looked at their potential to emit and looked at the thresholds that they would possibly pass if they with their current emissions, and that set them clearly in the minor source category based on what they have currently constructed and can operate. So we felt that was the most fair approach possible.
And before we start penalty matrix, Jeff Kinder, for the record, there is a substantial difference between major and minor source penalties.
Yes.
So I'll ballpark figures the difference. Trying to get ahead of Mr. Richardson's question. He's training me. So the difference was on the magnitude of from, we're talking the two of these being in the $47,000 range to about $137,000. So there is a substantial difference there. With that, if there are no more questions, I'll go through the penalty matrix. So for NOAV 2585, for the failure to meet the timeline for testing, I'll again try and get ahead of Mr. Richardson with a math question and expose an error that we made. So for the base penalty, when we did this, you can see we issued the violations and then had an enforcement conference the next day. That was at the request of the facility because they were going to be in town. So we rushed to get the violations issued and calculate the penalties. In doing that, we inadvertently looked at the class one penalty for this part of it, and we issued $1,000 per system per month instead of $600 for a class two facility. And we also issued 1 month for each. As we were getting ready, we looked at seeing each was we felt that each one was a month overdue at that time. So that totaled three systems at $1,000 each at a month each is $3,000. Subsequent to that, I realized that we had charged the class one. I looked at it $600 per system per month. However, one system was 3 months overdue, which gives you a total of 5 months overdue. And 5 times 6 times 1 is 3,000. So it actually ended up working out perfectly. So
is that going to pass your screen?
It's the right number.
So just by fluke, we ended up with the right number. So I chose not to update this and go through renoticing and whatnot, but chose to bring it to your attention here verbally. So that's a base penalty of $3,000. There were no deviation factors. Number of tests is 1 for each system, so a multiplier of 1. We've already considered each system in the base penalty. They do have 4 previous violations within the past 60 months. That's a 20% multiplier, adding an additional $600 for a total penalty of $3,600. Are there any questions on
just the fact that this has been multiple infractions? What do you say about that? Are they just What's going on with them? Is it they have multiple infractions?
I have a quick history of their violations in case you asked. They did a failure to for record keeping, which is pretty minor. One was fairly major. They had operated a piece of equipment without the air pollution control device in place, but my understanding, it was before my time, was they were reactionary and took care of that. The violation was issued, but it seemed like they tried to take care of that as quickly as possible. And then they have a failure to control fugitive dust, which is pretty minor, and then a failure to comply with a permitted emission limit, which will come into play on the next violation and drastically increase the fees. So,
okay. Any questions from the commission so far on this first one?
I have a couple of questions. Did the company provide a reason why they were unplugged?
They have been going through bankruptcies. They are on a skeleton crew right now. I personally visited the site for the inspection after, and actually for the source test as well. We did dual inspection source test. They were down to three people in the environmental office, one being the mining engineer, one being the environmental person, and one being the manager. I feel that they were pretty overwhelmed, and it slipped through the cracks. And I feel that as soon as they were aware of it, they scheduled testing to get it as soon as possible. Again, scheduling testing takes time. The companies are all busy. You have to provide us with a protocol 30 days in advance saying how you're going to test, and then give us the opportunity to be there. And sometimes testing can be 3 to 4 months out on a facility or a testing company schedule. So
is the 3 month, 15 month time limitations, is that in the state regulations or federal?
Jeff Kinder, for the record, that's the federal rule.
That's the federal rule.
The state rule requires an annual test, but isn't as specific as the federal rules are.
So we're finding them both on state violation and federal violation here?
Correct. And notice of alleged violation 2585, finding them on the federal rule. On the second one, it's violation of the state permit. However, I will note we are the delegated authority for the federal mercury max, so it is our responsibility to implement it and enforce it.
So did they then come into compliance with testing? Are they still running their refinery? Because these are all refineries, right? There's
correct.
Three torts and a furnace.
Correct.
Right. It's my understanding that they've retested and have taken steps to correct the issues that were in place.
So they're still operating the refinery?
They are currently, to my understanding.
Why, I guess my last question, because I guess I was aware of the state of Nevada coming out very proactively with mercury limitations that related mainly to mining refineries and so forth, because there were mercury emissions there. And then the feds came out with something similar modeled after it. I mean, and what you mentioned there, Jeff, is that the state limits are significantly below the federal limits, and that these numbers would have actually passed the federal limits. Is there a reason to go back and look at the state limits? Have we been so stringent that we're pushing people into violations here because the equipment's not actually capable of doing the scrubbing that our limits in the state are requiring?
Jeff Kinder, for the record, when the state program was proposed and eventually implemented, it was done based on testing at Nevada Mines, and the Nevada Mining Association was very active, proactive in this process. So the numbers, the NVMAC determination, if you will, that these mines are held to was basically done in partnership with us and the mining industry. And these standards are low, but they are achievable based on pretty common control technology. So I would argue that we should maintain the state emission limits as negotiated with the mining industry. And I don't know if these numbers are completely accurate, but we're in the hundreds of pounds per year, where going to the federal limit, we would be in the thousands of pounds of mercury emitted a year. And the methodology is different. The federals look at it as a blanket number for the entire facility, where we are equipment specific.
Okay. So there's no real pattern here of the limits are so low that the equipment can't meet them. This was a So it's a maintenance issue or something with the scrubbing system here?
Correct. The vast majority of our facilities are able to meet their emission limits doing annual testing. I will note this facility has a slightly different manufacturing type of approach than other mines do, because when this mine was originally proposed, it was a very large-scale mine. They have different types of retorts than other facilities use, and they have been problematic. And I know the facility is looking at what other mines are using to be more consistent with what other Nevada mines are doing.
Bottom line, I want to hear is there is equipment out there that can meet these state requirements without a lot of problems.
Yes, sir.
We receive numerous testing reports that mines pass our limits on a regular basis.
And this program has been in place since 2008. And we have history of facilities meeting their annual limits each and every year.
And I think it's important. You stated that, again, if I heard correctly, that the industry itself didn't take you on this.
That is correct. It was a very proactive process, the establishment of the Nevada Mercury Control Program.
Okay. Questions from the commission? Any more? Any further questions?
Before we go on, may I please ask for a corrected copy of the calculation for the minutes, just so we have an accurate calculation on records?
Yes, absolutely.
Just a question of clarification. Did you say that they discovered that they were overdue on their testing when you went out to visit them? Was that how they realized that they were a month late and a month late and 18 months late?
So they were already aware of the issue when I went out for the testing. That's part of the reason that I went out with my inspector. Per recollection, my inspector is not in the room, but based off of my memory, it was self-reported and self-discovered, and then they scheduled it.
Thank you.
Okay. Any comments from the audience, from the public, either in Vegas or here? Okay. Would you like us to act on this particular one first and then go to the second one?
Okay, the recommendation is combined.
Is it a combined recommendation?
Yes, correct.
Okay, then continue.
Quick note to remember to get valve directions. Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone from Mycroft here?
Pardon?
Is there anyone from Mycroft here?
Again, Val King, for the record, I contacted Hycroft, and they indicated that they would not be present, and they did not contest the penalty.
So Travis Ostrout, for the record, to go over the penalty matrix for NOAV 2586. So the base penalty for this is $2,500 from page 2 of the penalty matrix for a failed source test for Class 2 facility general pollutant. For the volume of release additional deviation factors, we broke into the two systems that failed. System 1 was 208% of the permit limit, for an adjustment of 2.08, again proportional to the exceedance. And then system 2 was 341% of the permit limit, and again for adjustment factor of 3.41 proportional to the exceedance. So multiplying the base penalty of $2,500 times 2.08 for system 1 yields $5,200, and multiplying $2,500 base penalty times 3.41 for system 2 yields a penalty of $8,525. Add those two together for a total of $13,725. Again, this is based on the number of tests, so a multiplier of 1 based on the time basis guideline for the penalty matrix. There again was no economic benefit taken into account, and here's where the previous violation comes into account. Within 3 years of a similar violation, so another failed source test, it's a 200% multiplier. So it starts to climb drastically. And then they also have 4 previous violations within the last 5 years for a total of 220% additional adjustment factors, which takes our total to $43,920 for the failed source tests.
Just a general question. Evidently, the state must look at mercury pretty seriously. So tell us, is mercury bad?
Jeff Kinder, for the record, there's been many studies on mercury. Once it gets into the environment, you know, from getting into waterways, being accumulated in things such as fish, there's been many studies. So, yes, I would say mercury is bad.
So we should take mercury infractions seriously, is what you're saying, because it's a poisonous subject.
Yes, sir. And just to add on to that, you know, our mercury limits are much lower than our other criteria pollutants that you normally see in our operating permits, just for that reason, because of the health-based issues with mercury.
And Travis Hillshout, for the record, in our instance, we're dealing with emissions that are emitted into the air, which can be inhaled as well. So
okay.
As they cook the ore, the mercury from the soils are vaporized. And
okay. I just want to make sure I keep things in perspective here as far as what the pollutant is. Okay, any other questions, comments from the commission, please?
You mentioned that they're in bankruptcy. So are they in a position to pay this fine, and how does being in bankruptcy affect what are the other tools available to ensure that they aren't just declared bankruptcy protection and walk away?
Jeff Kinder, for the record, they've been in bankruptcy for quite a while. They requested bankruptcy protection, especially when the economy slowed down and the price of gold dropped. They have been working their way out of it. They are actively mining. I believe in the enforcement conference we've had those discussions, and again, they didn't contest the penalty or notify us of any issues with paying the penalty.
So you feel you very well may be able to collect on the penalty?
Yes, sir.
Travis Hillshout, for the record, from the enforcement conference, I do feel they'll be able to pay it, and we did discuss with them the challenges of mercury not being directly addressed in the penalty matrix and the Title V Class II options in our decision and why we came that to that decision. So,
okay, thank you.
The commission, comments, questions? Al, I assume this representative is not here on this one. Right? Okay. Any comments from the audience or the public in Vegas or here? Okay, seeing none, back to the commission. I think we're ready for a motion if there's no further discussion.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the penalties recommended for Highcroft Resources and Development Incorporated of $3,600 for NOAV 2585 and $43,920 for NOV 2586.
I'll second that.
Second. Any discussion or comments on the motion? If not, I hear none. All those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion carries.
Thank you. We appreciate your time and consideration.
You know, you guys are answering our questions. What's wrong here?
Practice makes perfect.
Thank you.
Okay, we go on to number 9 now. Gentlemen, this kind of set the tone for you. It looks pretty complex. This is a very important subject, as far as I'm concerned, living in Clark County for the last 65 years and what they're trying to do with reclaimed water. So please make this as straightforward. Give us the background and make sure we understand what you're talking about. Okay?
No pressure. Gotcha. All right, well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Nick Brothers, Supervisor of the Water Pollution Control Permitting Branch. With me is Peter Lassley and Bureau Chief Bruce Holmgren. For background on this particular regulatory petition, we live in a very arid state. We are part of the West, and in the recent drought, increased interest in reclaimed water uses has been on the top of many of our minds. So during that time, the Reuse Steering Committee was formed, as well as the Governor's Drought Forum, which began in 2015, I believe. With those efforts, we wanted to look specifically at long-term planning and alternative water sources. So the regulations proposed are needed to provide clear regulatory pathways for the regulated community to pursue indirect potable reuse projects, as well as these regulations will encourage and expand reclaimed water uses throughout Nevada, hopefully. It is our interest that we form the Reuse Steering Committee and try to involve many partners when pursuing these regulations. I'll list some of them. NDEP with Bureau of Water Pollution Control, Bureau of Safe Drinking Water, Southern Nevada Water Authority and Truckee Meadows Water Authority, Las Vegas Valley Water District, City of Reno, the City of Sparks, Washoe County, Clark County, Lyon County as a rural community representative, the Nevada Association of Counties, the Division of Water Resources, and representatives from the consulting industry. The committee worked for 18 months to draft the proposed regulations and even coordinated a review with the National Water Research Institute for their input. I hope that's enough background for you. So I'll go into what's in the petition. The major items which we wanted to address was to create a new reclaimed water category, A+, which would involve advanced treatment to meet drinking water standards, both primary and secondary, and also meet pathogen removal sufficient to protect public health. Those limitations were modeled off of other common reuse practices in other states in the West. In addition, requirements for indirect potable reuse projects may include holding public workshops and involving the communities where these projects would take place. That would include noticing requirements and holding the workshops in 30-day comment periods, similar to other permitting processes. Those comments and responses and the kind of summary of that process would be submitted with their application for the project for permitting from water pollution control for these projects. An engineering report detailing the proposed operation and the scientific exploration of how it will work and how they're going to meet the removal numbers. In addition, we're adding a new fee court category to address indirect potable reuse projects through spreading basins, which is surface infiltration through a basin into an aquifer for extraction. We would also need to add a fee category for indirect potable reuse projects where injection wells are used, because that is a separate regulation portion, where injection into the aquifer occurred directly. Throughout the regulations, we have adjusted language to change treated effluent to reclaimed water, as that's a more common and encouraging term. As we were going through this, we wanted to address a couple of other items. Administrative continuance of underground injection control permits has been added to be consistent with other permitting activities and current practice. And on-site sewage disposal systems have been made consistent to be 5,000 gallons per day or greater to be considered a Class 5 well, which is consistent with other regulation and our EPA reporting requirements for UIC. We were able to move forward with these regs successfully so far and held public workshops. Noticing of the workshops occurred per the regulation on NDEP notices on our website through listserv email notification, physical posting at the workshop locations, and publication in the Reno Gazette Journal, Elko Daily Free Press, Las Vegas Review Journal, and it was also submitted to the Nevada Association of Counties for distribution amongst their members. Workshops were held in Carson City on September 19th with 10 attendees. It was held in Las Vegas on September 20th with 17 attendees, and in Elko on the 21st of September with 3 attendees. Of those that participated in public workshops, public works agencies, consultants, and the regulated community were all represented. We did not see any general public interest throughout this period. Verbal and written comments have been received, and go through those with you for one moment. The regulated community had voiced concerns regarding proposed language to clarify when fencing may be required around reclaimed water impoundments. NDEP decided to drop this language as it obviously wasn't clarifying if everyone had so many concerns about it. This does not change the way that we do business in water pollution control, and we would continue to work with permittees on a case-by-case basis for site restrictions regarding access. NDEP also received comment on language regarding prohibition on direct evaporative cooling. The comments received were requesting clarification on the language and what the prohibition was regarding. Our interest is to prohibit direct evaporative cooling where the air which comes into contact with reclaimed water would be vented into a workspace or a building where people would be in there. That is because we don't have enough health information to know if that would be appropriate to permit. The result of that is that we had modified the language to be more clear on what it is we were proposing a prohibition of. In addition to those comments, we received numerous letters of support from all the various stakeholders. Small business impacts are not expected, as currently there are no projects of this type in the state. And we would urge you to adopt the regulatory petition to continue to promote augmentation, long-range planning, and diversify the state's water resources.
To me, this is a resource. Reclaimed water is a resource. And it's going to have a price. I know, I don't think these regs address that at all. That's going to be a private sector thing, because this is going to be a valuable resource. It's going to demand being paid for.
Yeah, currently NDEP is not involved with any of the pricing of reclaimed water deliveries from the...
That'd be the local governments and the... Okay.
Yeah, I presume the better it's treated, the more expensive it'll be.
Yeah. Jason, you can correct me for my next statement, because you're the expert, not me, but one of the things that really strikes me is when Laughlin came into being, the only reason we could even have a Laughlin was because Laughlin took 20,000 acre feet of a return flow credit from the Las Vegas Valley, and that was looked at as Laughlin's water resource. So they could draw 20,000 acre feet out of the Colorado for their water supply, because Las Vegas is putting in reclaimed water into the Colorado River system. So I think really sometimes this reclaimed water becomes water and allows growth and allows, you know, usages that normally we wouldn't have. Is that still okay?
Yes.
Okay. So I just really place a lot of emphasis on reclaimed water and what we're doing to them. And I think you guys have a high profile in regulating this and making sure that we make it available to everybody that possibly can use it, but at the same time protecting the public, because it's not pure water. Or most of it is in pure water, and the public doesn't know. Like you said, nobody from the public is interested in coming to your workshops.
No, which was actually a little surprising, but
yes,
I thought there would be more interest, but people were happy to use the water that's available nowadays, I think.
Yes. Well, we got to protect the public. I mean, for make sure we don't have any hazards associated with the use of that water. So you guys got to be really careful with that. It's almost two opposing forces. Get it out there and use as much as we can, everywhere we can, because we don't have a lot of water, while at the same time protecting it so somebody doesn't get hurt by its use. So, do you feel you've done that?
Yes, sir, absolutely. If so, we may be a little on the conservative side. We're going all the way to meeting secondary standards, which are just really recommendations for contaminant levels on taste and things like that from the drinking water program. Before going into an environmental buffer that's not direct to a pipe or to delivery, but into the ground as a future resource.
Right. Okay. And we're not going to be contaminating groundwater by doing this?
No, sir.
Okay. I would get off my podium here and let somebody else talk from the commission if there are any questions or comments.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious, which states are most comparable in their regulations to this?
Both Arizona and California have similar regulations regarding A-plus quality water and the other various uses that we outlined.
Would you say ours is more stringent than those two states or less stringent?
Similar. We're slightly, possibly more restrictive than California, I would say, even. Okay. California has had some of these reclaimed water regulations in place for a long period of time, and they have had more experience with food crops and stuff. They've relaxed their regulations over that time period, I believe.
Is there any permitted use discussed in this regulation that California and Arizona wouldn't allow? Or, for example, mining or the concentrated livestock?
No. Okay. Not that I'm aware of.
We had a member of our hydrology section also participate in this process, and obviously we were a huge proponent of what is being proposed. But I wanted to maybe make a statement that to maybe spotlight a little bit of a vulnerability here, but I need you to correct me if I'm completely wrong. It's my understanding that this indirect potable reuse water, if it's going to be extracted from an extraction well, it can be put into a spreading basin, and I'm distinguishing that from a rapid infiltration basin. It has to be of water quality standard grade if it's going to be extracted later from an extraction well, versus we have aquifer storage and recovery projects all the time where water is put into a rib, but it doesn't have to meet water quality standards. It has to be of equal or greater quality, is my understanding. It has just been pointed out that, and I know especially domestic well users, and I'm thinking of Pahrump, are concerned that, well, that's fine. Under a rib situation, you're just putting a water quality that is less than A+. And in fact, my domestic well is an extraction well. I'm pumping it out, and I'm using it for my use. I just wanted to point that out, that is there any kind of a liability there that someone say, well, now look at this new regulation. You have to have water quality standard, drinking water quality standard water, put into a spreading basin if you're going to extract it from a well, versus I'm using my domestic well, it is an extraction well, and the water quality that we're discharging to a rib is of less quality. Was that discussed? Is that a legal issue? And I know that's the rules the way they are right now, too. So, I mean, it's not really changing that part of it, but it does kind of highlight to me a little bit of a gap. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does, and during our steering committee discussions, we had touched on that topic a few times and really came down to the intent of indirect potable reuse project is that this water is going to be specifically targeted, whatever aquifer it goes to, shallow through a spreading basin, that water is going to be pulled out by public water agency for delivery to their customers or treatment and then delivery, however they propose the project. The intent of that is really what it comes down to between those two operations. RIBs are strictly disposing of water that's been treated. Yeah, I was surprised residents did not come to the workshop to bring up that topic.
I mean, it's been in the papers in Pahrump. I'm amazed in Vegas you didn't have 500 people. But again, I'm a proponent of what's being done. I'm just
Jason, how do you fill that gap?
I don't know how you do that, because the counter argument is, listen, we're not changing anything from what it is right now in terms of a domestic well owner adjacent to a rib. That is the current law. In terms of the water quality standards that's being put in that rib. So we're not taking anything away. Where is the harm? where could you show a takings in a court? We're just saying that if to the gentleman's point about the intent is to then later extract it from a municipal well, then we have this new higher level A-plus source of water, and that's a good thing. So that was a long-winded answer to, I don't know how you fill that gap. I'm sure it's defensible. I'm just saying I could see someone somewhere maybe wanting to file a suit. But anybody can do that anytime.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, especially when we have areas with a lot of on-site sewage disposal systems for residences and private wells on the same property, where that's clearly not a plus, but maybe accidentally being recovered over long periods of time. So, in this regulation, we proposed that when it is intended to be recovered, that we have points of compliance at the aquifer or at the extraction well for the various constituents, and that the category A drinking water had to be met at the aquifer or demonstrated to be met at the aquifer when it was intended to be drained.
Rick, I got to hear from you on this.
Well, as I am going to jump in on Jason there, because I actually remember a few of these when I was a councilman in Elko on development. There are required distances of setback between rapid infiltration basins for effluent currently without the changes here, and the shortest distance to a domestic well. And as I recall in your regs, that's 1,000 feet. So there's some buffer there that I think maybe addresses that. Is that enough? I don't know. Right now, and I'm trying to see the bigger picture of this and understand what drives it. I understand water conservation does to a great extent, but currently today in Nevada, we use treated effluent, and the terms that I'm used to is class A, class B, and class C, right? And that's what you're talking about when you say A+. And that has to do with the number of critters logarithmically, something or other, right? And our treated effluent coming out of municipalities is used, on golf courses a lot. That's how we run municipal golf courses. Some is discharged under NPDES permits, right? I assume that like Reno Sparks, that's the case there in the river. And some is used for irrigation where it can be, for non-food crops, alfalfa mainly. So now I'm going to ask you, if we approve this, how is that going to give me an example of a project, a small one and a big one. Walk me through the flow sheet of what this is actually going to enable. Is Reno and Sparks all of a sudden going to drill a bunch of reinjection wells instead of putting it in the river and start putting it in the ground and building, municipal wells some distance from there and pumping that water? I mean, what does this mean?
Yeah, that is a possibility. So that is one example, exactly. Truckee Meadows Water Reclamation Facility has requirements under the Truckee River Operating Agreement to put a certain amount back, but of their acre feet, which they can deliver for reclaim purposes to various users, that water could be put into an aquifer through an injection well or a spreading basin and reclaimed by Tumwa at some other location, should they get permitted to do that. So this provides an outline of what items the division would like to be submitted to entertain that type of a project. And that would be the new use under a category A+ requirement.
So we're mainly talking about, the big volumes of water here are basically treated effluent from municipalities going into reinjection wells, or what did you? I'm not
spreading basin.
Spreading basin. I'm familiar with the rib, but what's a spreading basin?
It's a rib that's only used for Class A+ water.
Okay, new term. Yes.
And that definition.
You need an acronym for that now.
So when you're referring to Class A+ water, you're talking about Class A+ treated effluent.
Yeah, so this would be reclaimed water, which the various categories are bacteriological testing limits. A would be non
essentially non-detect for fecal coliforms and total coliforms. And A-plus would be that limitation of non-detect for total coliforms, as well as the drinking water standard.
Okay. So apply. From what I understand, a good deal of effluent water that's generated is relatively high in nitrate. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so that water that may be high in nitrate is not A-plus. So we're not going to put nitrate-laden water back into the aquifer. Or perhaps there's a process by which when it moves through the aquifer, the nitrate is removed or scrubbed away from that. Is that how does nitrate come into play on something like this?
Water intended for this purposes would have to meet the drinking water nitrogen requirements, so it should be less than 10 nitrate milligrams per liter.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll just add, it really touches on what you talked about initially with the return flow credits. Maybe just more for education for everybody else. There are situations where that reclaimed water already belongs to someone else, like in the Truckee Meadows. That water, there is a certain amount that has to get back to the Truckee River to get down to Pyramid Lake because other people have senior water rights on it. So this has its limitations, the use of this reclaimed water, depending on where you are in the state. You gave the great example of Las Vegas Valley. Las Vegas metropolitan area is able to turn their 300,000 acre-feet of Colorado River resource into almost 500,000 acre-feet because of the return flow credits. If you started taking that water and taking it somewhere else, that's a problem, and I see you have that exemption that appears in the regulations talking about that. So, again, as someone who works for a regulatory agency that manages water resources, we have to you know, spread every drop of water we have, but there's limitations with downstream water users and water right holders.
Excuse me. This is Bruce Holmgren for the record. But it does give the municipalities and the treatment plants options. You know, if they want to negotiate agreements where maybe they don't have to return as much water, or if they want to buy water rights from other downstream users, it will allow them to have options.
Absolutely.
To address the drought conditions. So.
Again, Jason, correct me. I've been away from it way too long, but one of the things that Pat Mulroy and I used to discuss when I was at the Sand District and she was at the Water District was that the price of water was, you weren't paying for water, you were paying for power. Because that water was coming all the way across the Las Vegas Valley down to the treatment plant, only to be pumped back up the valley to be used as a reclaimed water. And she was saying, why are we doing this? Why don't we put the treatment plants up at the other end of the valley, just treat it there and use it where it's at? Does this allow that?
Suppose someone could propose to integrate the treatment facilities, but I don't know that the sewage collection systems are typically all gravity systems, and therefore the sewage treatment side is always the low end of the valley or the community.
But when you have this much population in the Las Vegas Valley, you don't have to site those treatment plants down at the Las Vegas Wash anymore. You used to have to. Because that just didn't have enough water going down anywhere else. But now there's so much generation of wastewater that you can actually site these plants somewhere else in the valley, not down at the lowest part, and still get enough water into that treatment plant to treat it and then use it somewhere for reclaim purposes, for irrigation, golf courses, whatever.
Yeah, there actually are a couple of examples of that,
yes,
in Clark County already with the Durango Hills Water,
yes,
Resource Center, for example.
Yes.
Whether or not they could go to an A-plus quality would be up to the utility, and then they could have this use applied to that permit in that location.
Okay.
That is a potential possibility.
Bruce Holmgren again. It gives them the option, but that would be a local decision.
Yes. But I want to make sure
that this doesn't frustrate that somehow. No, it does not.
That's what I'm really concerned more about. Those kind of scenarios, like Rick was asking, give me an example of a small one and a big one. I just want to try to, in my own mind, say, well, now, will these regs somehow frustrate this or not protect this and the public's at danger or something like that? I always try to figure out what the objective is and what the consequences are of our wrecks. Okay, Ken, any other comments by commission?
Just one thing that kind of goes back along the lines, because I'm sure, you know, in time, as these projects come forward, but it just seems like we can't make any more water. We're reusing it here. But somewhere there's a loser, isn't there? That's not going to get water that now is going to get reused. And I don't understand that well enough. Like Jason said, you know, you have to go back to the Truckee because there's senior water rights owners. Because ultimately, you know, it's going to be pumped up. There's going to be water rights for it, right?
Certainly there are areas, and you know this, Rich, in the state. I'm trying to think of some bigger cities besides, obviously, Las Vegas and Reno, where that reclaimed water could become another resource without impairing someone else. So I certainly think that exists, and I take Mr. Holmgren's comment to heart, because it does give options to at least manage their portfolio. You make a great point about Chairman Gans, about being able to, instead of sending it down and paying to pump it, if you could actually convince Bureau of Reclamation and your Colorado River partners that I can still get those return flow credits in the basin without sending it to the lake, that would save a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I absolutely see this is a good thing. I'm just, to me, the jury's out a little bit on how much it's going to get used.
Yeah, I agree. More comments, questions from the...
A couple quick items. When you touched on evaporative cooling, where direct evaporative cooling due to health concerns is not recommended. However, indirect evaporative cooling is an accepted use of it, correct?
Correct.
Okay. For me, on the injection wells, it really came down to the definition of an environmental buffer. And it's a naturally occurring zone provides sufficient retention time for reclaimed water before the reclaimed water is recovered. Sufficient retention time, it seems that, you know, this is very specific to the geological conditions of that particular location, and there could be some degradation of that over time. What's in place how do you go about determining, from a science perspective, what is sufficient retention time and ensuring that that doesn't degrade over time?
So I think a good example of that would be enteric virus removal in the aquifer. They degrade over time. So months of storage, travel time from your injection well to your extraction well could sufficiently add removal of enteric virus. But to your comment, there might be some type of geologic changes over a long period of time or by other activities in that area, which change that travel time between wells. Those types of evaluations would have to be presented in the engineering report for the permit to operate that. And it could be reevaluated like on an every 5-year basis with the new permit cycle.
So do you have the tools that you need to ensure that the engineering with the sufficient retention time not only is determined, but is also enforced and maintained as things could change over time?
That'll be the responsibility of those providing the engineering report to provide sufficient evidence to the permitting agency that we agree that they're demonstrating that.
Are parameters established for that, or?
Yes, there's a 12 log removal, which has to be demonstrated throughout the treatment train for like enteric virus, and a 10 log removal for, sorry, I always pronounce things wrong, well, Giardia and Cryptosporidium. So those log removal requirements would be from raw sewage throughout all the way to extraction. And those log removal credits would come from, well, maybe this treatment unit provides 6 log removal in this system, and then we have another 8 log removal with this RO unit, and 4 log in the aquifer prior to extraction for, I think it's 1 log per month. So
those types of things would have to be demonstrated for the whole project in order to be permitted.
And those requirements are already laid out and established?
Those requirements are specific to indirect potable reuse regulations in other states and are, I guess, common practice for IPR projects.
Because that, you know, we had two ways to control it. One is the quality of water you're putting in the ground and then what the ground's doing to it. So I'm just wanting to make sure it's easier to control what's going in the ground, but then controlling and understanding what's happening over time is my simple mind how I look at the, you know, potential issue of some contamination to the aquifer. So I just want to make sure you guys have the tools in place and the parameters in place to ensure that this somewhat qualitative definition of the environmental buffer is going to be a very quantitative engineering and enforceable process.
Yeah, the level of log removal that was placed into these regulations is required to be split up between different treatment units or credits allowed from different treatment locations, like advanced filtration or microfiltration may give you some log credit, and then through the soil aquifer treatment may give you some credit, and other treatment methods, RO or whatever the facility uses, coagulation and filtration. Okay. But we tried to build that in with having separate treatment trains have to add up to getting the total amount. That provides redundancy.
So you're comfortable that we have the processes in place, redundancies to ensure that we're not running the risk of, it's the injection that concerns me. I love the concept. It's just always a concern once we put it down there.
Yeah, they will have to, we have the discretion on how many log removal we can give them for environmental buffer treatment, and that would have to be demonstrated in that engineering report with a proper model and renewed every 5 years. Currently, that's the way I envision the policy being carried out. The regulation gives us the discretion to provide log credits for that, or to scale those back if we feel uncomfortable with the geology or something like that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Perry.
Yes.
This sounds to me like a lot like fracking.
No, I don't think so. Actually, I was sitting here thinking that some of the analog to this of Carrie's concerns our known technology in the geothermal industry is, because of geothermal, you pump hot water up, you remove the heat, and then you reinject it. And they actually are fairly sophisticated with various types of dye tracers to determine how long it takes for reinjection from the time it gets pumped back up to kind of unravel the subsurface flow regimes. Because, you know, as you say, eventually, I mean, soils are great at attenuating all kinds of things, right? And but that's because they have high clay contents and they didn't do anything about it. And eventually those clays do load up to the point where they no longer will do their job, you know. So I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I think there's some technology out there. I'm sure in Jason's world he's seen some of it too, that where people have tried to prove, you know, what are the flow regimes down there, how long does it take, what's the retention time. A lot of these areas that have these rapid infiltration basins have mounding. Monitoring wells around, and you can see the mounting of the water levels coming up into the soil. So it can take a fair amount of monitoring, I would assume, to really see how well these things perform.
I think permitting the first project will be exciting and extensive, the amount of information that we get.
Are there comments or questions from the commission? Okay, we go to the public. Anybody in Vegas would like to speak to this, or anybody in the audience here want to speak to this?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, and please state your name.
Absolutely. My name is Dan Fisher from the Clark County Water Reclamation District. I'm the Deputy General Manager. Thank you, Mr. Gans, for allowing me to speak, and then commissioners. Just wanted to simply say that the Water Reclamation District has supported these new regulations. There's a couple reasons for that. One is, as you said, Chairman, this expansion of our water resources is a necessary thing. But we believe that the way the regulations are written will protect public health and safety. The other reason is this process has been a collaborative one, and we compliment for the execution of this in a rapid and organized way. All the stakeholders were able to input, and we believe that that's going to result in a regulation that will be a success. Lastly, it sounded like there was some concern on the commission's part that somehow that these new regs might impede the ability of a treatment system like ours, especially in rural areas, to dispose of effluent via rapid infiltration basins, and that's not the case, that these regulations do not impede that, and that kind of release of effluent into RIVs will be able to continue to be done. So that's it. Just wanted to indicate that we are supportive and appreciate being part of the process.
Mr. Fisher, this is Jim Gans. I think something's slipping at the sanitation district when you write such a glowing letter to the state. I'd have never let that happen when I was there.
Good observation, sir. Got no comment on that.
No, I think it's very important that the sanitation district have a high profile in this kind of situation because of the potential we can use for this clean, clean water. So I want to comment and say that I'm really happy that you guys followed this through and was a party, an active party to it. So thank you very much.
Our pleasure.
Anybody else in the audience, here or there?
Speaking sure. Here or
right here. Come forward, please.
Thank you for the seat. Mr. Chair, Commissioners, my name is Rick Warner, and today I'm representing Washoe County, Nevada. I'm a senior engineer in Washoe County, been 30 years experience in Nevada working extensively in drinking water, reclaimed water, wastewater issues. And also professionally, I represent, as a national president, 33,000 water professionals that deal extensively in this issue, predominantly in Southern California, Texas, Arizona, Florida. These are my colleagues, and I was privileged enough to be asked to be on the state steering committee for this important work. And over the last 18 months, I just have to applaud the state commission for sponsoring the project, and of course, NDEP and their professionalism and their staff. They're very proactive and professional. They've interacted with all of the major water and wastewater utilities throughout the state, and also invited international and national experts to review the draft regulations. I can say just from my experience nationally that the proposed regulations are very consistent with regulations that have been in place in other states for many, many years, decades of use, in fact, safely promoting groundwater injection augmentation in Southern California and Arizona and like. So I'm very, very pleased to be able to present to you my qualifications, I think, as an expert to support not only professionally, individually, but also on behalf of Washoe County, that this has been an absolutely terrific process. Others have already commented, and I would say that Washoe County supports the assessment that these regulations are protective of the environment and also public health. Mr. Brothers explained about the regulatory and sort of water quality protections that are in place for both the injection and surface spreading, and we wholeheartedly agree with the assessment these are protective of public health. And we'd also say that based upon our expertise and evaluation of other projects that have been in decades of use, that the spreading basins have a seemingly large capacity to accept reclaimed water. And again, reemphasizing that any aquifer that receives highly treated reclaimed water, either by spreading basins or direct injection, will meet and exceed drinking water standards. So I think the representation is very supportive of sound science. I would also mention to you, too, that although there's no
prescribed Northern Nevada project at this time, that the agencies, Reno Sparks, Washoe County, and others, we've assembled teams to sort of investigate if these proposed regulations offer us benefit in Northern Nevada. And to the point of kind of winners and losers, there could be absolutely a scenario in which there would be no losers, that highly reclaimed water could be returned to the environment and fresh water remain in our streams and our lakes for other environmental and recreational uses. So these regulations are not only protective of public health, they also could potentially support high-tech industries, recreation, environmental projects, and so forth. So with high confidence, I can represent that Washoe County supports the regulations and really applauds the state process that included many, many agencies and organizations and a vast array of state agencies as well. So thank you for the time and the opportunity to present before you, Mr. Camps.
Any questions or comments?
I have a quick question. Was there anything with the regulation that, if you could, you would change?
No, I think all the agency that has had very adequate time to review with the state, and we brought in additional experts to review the regulations. Most of them, I won't go into the minutia, but there's very technical things about, of course, virus protection, pathogen reduction, total coliform reduction, total organic carbon reduction. So the layers that go through these regulations have been very well vetted. Plus, I think what I really like about the state's approach is not only are they based upon sound science and meeting drinking water standards, but this concept of making sure that the proponents bring forward a detailed engineering study that includes the hydrogeologic investigations, and then we'll have to do long-term monitoring compliance as well. So I think there's also provisions in this regulations, if they're still there, that really the proponents of this project would have to be a fairly large, substantial municipal utility that demonstrates the technical, managerial, financial capability to not only do the project but maintain it for years and years to come. So the public would be perpetually protected, and the environment would be protected as well. So I'm very supportive, and I don't think I'd make any changes at all.
Where else are we headed to? What's next? Where's the steering committee steering us to?
Well, that's at the pleasure of Mr. Holmgren, but I can say I think I can represent the full committee that probably is 15 to 20 folks, that we've had just an absolutely terrific experience, and the state has really taken on a very proactive approach, so appreciate your time.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public? That brings us back to the commission. There's no further discussion or questions, then the motion is in order.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt regulatory petition R101-16 related to the reuse of reclaimed water.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded to approve this new regulation. Is there any comments or questions on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None heard? Motion passes. Good job. You guys can't be on your toes on this.
Thank you.
Okay. Jennifer, that brings you forward, I think. And you will tell Dave that I'm really impressed how he's cleaned up his act, right?
Grew his hair
Sending
out.
You and yeah. him. It's a much better visual for me.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
See you soon.
Yeah. So, good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, for the record, I'm Jennifer Carr, Deputy Administrator for the Division of Environmental Protection. Dave Emmy does send his regrets today. He is on leave this week for very good reason, and so he asked me to fill in for him. I'm aware that you just had a meeting in October, and he must have done one of these briefings. I wasn't here in the last meeting, but I have a couple of items that I thought might be of interest to you.
Can you hold just one moment?
Absolutely.
Mark is leaving. Mm-hmm. Mark and Jason, I notice these lavender shirts you're wearing. Are you trying? I'm going back to Vegas and buy one now. I want to be part of the group.
Okay. I'll bring you one next meeting.
That's the new nonpartisan color, right?
Take care.
I'm sorry, Jennifer.
That's quite all right. So there are a couple of staffing changes. The first and foremost one being, if you haven't heard, we will have a new director of DCNR as of December 12th. We will have a gentleman named Bradley Crowell, who will be our new director since Leo retired late this summer. So it's pretty unprecedented for us. We were surprised to have someone coming in from the outside. So our process to educate and inform this new individual will be interesting to go through as the various agencies get to know Mr. Crowell. He is currently serving as the United States Department of Energy Assistant Secretary for Congressional, Intergovernmental, and External Affairs. Pretty long title, but I guess that comes with the fact that he's a Senate-confirmed position, and so the title needs to be impressive, I suppose. Now, he also has served as a senior advisor to the Secretary of Energy, and he has experience that he brings to the table in his career with the Natural Resources Defense Council, as well as having served on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., for the Senate office of Richard Bryan. So he brings an interesting array of experience to the position, and we look forward to meeting him. Beyond that, I'm reading from the press release, so I honestly don't know too much about the gentleman, but we will all get to know him in just a few weeks. So. The second second announcement I have to make is that we have filled our vacant deputy administrator position. There are three deputy administrators at NDEP. And when Dave took over as administrator in June of 2015, he held on to the two air programs and closely oversaw those directly for the last year and a half almost. But as of this coming Monday, I am very pleased to announce that Mr. Jeffrey Kinder will take on those duties as the deputy administrator for NDEP's air programs, as well as whatever Dave wants him to do. So he's not going to be able to get away with only regulating the air programs, but we are looking forward to him continuing to streamline and improve processes in the air programs. He's done a tremendous amount of work in that already. You've already heard regulations that have been amended into his permitting processes and those sorts of things that have helped our regulated community and the agency interact well. And then he will be asked to take some of those experiences and apply them into other areas of NDEP, because we are looking under Dave's tutelage to become a better business unit and look at better ways to operate our agency as we continue to fulfill our mission of protecting human health and the environment. So those projects are excellent to be a part of. Jeffrey has a great mix of private sector and NDEP experience, and we're really excited to have him as part of our leadership team. So we welcome Jeffrey on Monday. Dave thought you might be interested in just another item that give me something to talk about, because it's not quite noon. You know, if we look back at what has happened in 2016 and the challenges that our colleagues in Michigan have experienced, particularly in the city of Flint, we have been watching those events unfold, and we took hold of an opportunity that EPA has provided us in what they offered out in 2016 as a multi-purpose grant. And that basically was a grant to state agencies that allowed us to identify priority projects that were otherwise unfunded by our by the other grants that we receive from US EPA to do the business that we do every day. So this new EPA multipurpose grant has allowed us to apply for and obtain just under $90,000 in our drinking water program to embark on a voluntary project where we're going to be partnering with school districts to investigate the potential for lead and copper at elementary schools throughout Nevada, of which there are over 400. And you know, in general, compliance with the lead and copper rule in Nevada is very high. Right now we only have one regulated system that is in exceedance for lead, and to systems that are exceedance for copper. So we are enjoying the benefit of water quality that does allow many of our systems to be in compliance with the lead and copper rule. However, the way the rule is structured, schools themselves are not required to be tested. The rule is based on sampling within residential domestic units. And so some states have identified a gap and have been seeing interesting data when you go in and actually perform sampling and analysis at the schools themselves. And of course, with the elementary school children, pre-K, K through three, up to about fifth grade or so, being a sensitive subpopulation, sensitive to lead, we wanted to take a close look to within schools that are interested in participating in this program to do very targeted sampling at drinking water fountains and within the culinary facilities to see what those concentrations might be like throughout Nevada, particularly prioritizing our older schools and our historic schools. We still have a number of them throughout Nevada that are small. They're pre-K through 12. And they're in relatively historic buildings. We will prioritize the resources that we have for those schools first, and keeping schools built after 1989, maybe towards the end, so that we can ensure that we get as many schools that want to participate able to do so. So we really are excited about this as a partnering opportunity as well, so that our staff can work with water system operators in these areas that are serving water to these schools to get even a greater local connection between the water supplier and the school principals, the school district administrators, and the custodial staff for the schools, so that they can better understand the water that they receive and how it interacts with their school environment. Now, you might ask, what happens if there's a problem? We do want to be part of the solution. So we actually reserved about two-thirds of that funding, or $60,000, to be able to work through vendors that we have in the state to actually replace, purchase for replacement, drinking water fountains or kitchen faucets or those sorts of things where there is a culinary or drinking water connection to the child. And be able to take outdated materials and get them out of the system and replace them with new equipment that complies with the most current lead-free standard that was established in 2014. Now, if the problem turns out to be deeper than that, if it's a true plumbing problem where it's old, lead soldered pipe or those sorts of things, there are additional resources that we've identified with the USDA. Or we can work with the school to help identify capital improvement projects that might be done long term. We've already started some outreach with the Lyon County School District. They're very excited to embark on this. They would rather know than not know, which I'm hoping is the response we get statewide. Of course, the school district administrator's first question was, well, if there's a problem, are you going to shut my school down? And so we're going to be working very hard to establish in the coming weeks lots of outreach materials to tell them just what we are trying to do and what would happen in sort of their worst case scenario. And by the way, the answer is no, we don't shut the school down. We may have to shut a water fountain off or do various things to help flush the school in the morning or those sorts of things. But we would work with them to reduce the exposure of lead in our children's school environment. So that's all I have for today, but I'm happy to talk about either that project or anything else that you might like to chat about.
When will you get going on that?
The grant was just awarded at the end of September. It's in the process of being inserted into our state authorities, and the first step is to establish our contract with the Nevada State Health Lab, who will be doing the analysis. And so that that contract is in the works. And so we actually expect to begin outreach to schools after the first of the year. And it's a 2-year grant. So we will sort of spread things out. We'll go out from here do things more locally at the beginning because it's easier to do things locally, and then move out through northern Nevada and then towards the south over the course of the next year and a half, 2 years.
Comments or questions from the commission? Well, I hate to let her off this easy. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
Okay. Item 11 is our public comment again. If anyone in Vegas or here in this audience wishes to make any public comments for the record, you can do it now. Of course, we won't act on anything. It's not on our agenda. So does anybody want to say anything? I see none. So, Val, when's our next meeting?
Our next meeting is tentatively scheduled for May 3rd, 2017. If something comes up with NDEP before that, where we it's necessary to have an earlier meeting, then we'll go through the process of setting that up.
Yeah. Okay. But right now, May 3rd is,
May 3rd is on the
calendar, and we'll wait to see from there.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. If there's no further business, we'll adjourn the meeting.